You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 6th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
A woman who knows a thing or two about a fine font, Britain's most brilliant social and design commentator, 25 beautiful homes, and whatever happened to the streetside kiosk. Find out today on Edition 45 of The Stack. Yes, this week we'll be fawning over fonts. In studio, we'll have designer Catherine Dixon with her pick of those print publications that have their serifs in order. And Monocle regular, eminent cultural commentator, Pimlico co-resident Peter York is also in studio with his stack too. That's not all. We'll also be heading to New York and stopping by a subterranean pop-up pushing independently published magazines.
The best thing about being underground is that there's no cell phones. So people, when they come here and they have a book in their hands, they actually only concentrate on that book.
Hear, hear. All that right here on The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Edition 45 of The Stack here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brulé. Well, we're back at base briefly to wrap up production on Monocle Mediterraneo, and we're still glowing about auctioning off edition one of our magazine for $2,500 by a gentleman named Top in Bangkok last week. There's a lot to, of course, get through over the next 52 minutes or so, so let's say hello to our guests on this very summery Saturday. Now joining us around the table here in Studio One, very air-conditioned Studio One, on the hottest day of the year, I believe, so far in the UK. Finally, summer has arrived. Catherine Dixon is here, also Peter York. Catherine Dixon, a new voice and face for the program, I think even for Midori House in general. Catherine is a senior lecturer of graphic design at Central St. Martin's School of Art. Of course, a fine institution. We featured your new digs in the December-January issue of the magazine, I think gathered much excitement, and I'm sure probably created something of a spike in even more enrollments from overseas in our key markets. So you can blame us if there's more Yanks or Aussies, etc. You're a designer, you're a writer, you're a teacher. There are paragraphs and paragraphs about all of the various things that you've done. But I want to maybe focus on your new home and what a remarkable institution it is. Tell me, how has it been received so far? Because on one side, we've had a lot of people, again, this ongoing discussion. Of course, this was commissioned long before Where the Economy Is, and people saying, oh, it's all a bit elaborate and all of that. Of course, we think it's great. How have the students and also the faculty responded?
It's a great space to work. I mean, it's really great when you just walk up through King's Cross, the change, the dynamism of the area. When you walk up towards it, every day it's different. And it's just really inspiring when you walk in as a space. It has practical problems. It's taking a bit of bedding in.
Mm. So I'm wondering where the trees are, the greenery on the approach. It was the one thing that did slightly surprise me. I can sort of see graphically it's kind of beautiful and clean, but I part of me sort of wonders.
Actually, I quite like the fact that you've still got some of the old buildings which haven't been regenerated yet. And I think that gives it a kind of, kind of digs into the sort of slightly corporate edge. I don't like the fact that the square outside has got kind of caretakers, as it were. It's all very corporate. My favourite time is in the summer holidays when all the local mums from the local estates, because it's not, you know, historically it's not been the greatest of areas and quite impoverished still, when all the local mums bring their kids to run through the fountains. And I kind of love the way that that just totally cuts across the kind of corporate vision for those sort of public spaces.
Mm. You talk about the corporate side. Are you talking from a design perspective that and from a really sort of an architectural impression or the management of it as well?
The fact that, you know, it's a property developer in that space and it's all kind of very managed in that sense. And we are in the middle of that. And I quite like, you know, I think we quite like the fact that we are sort of in the middle and we're there first and everything is coming around us. That's quite nice at the moment. It's quite nice to have the Guardian kind of just across the way. Mm. Sense of sort of new startups and little things, projects happening around us, and the kind of rawness of the space. I hope it doesn't become too corporate in the future. I
mean, there's always a gnashing of teeth when a move like this happens and people leave institutions which are a bit higgledy-piggledy and they're run down. There's been so much discussion, of course, in this city. BBC World Service leaves rickety but very august Bush House. They go to New Broadcasting House and everyone's getting headaches from all of the red and whatnot. Has there been a similar discussion over the last sort of year, 18 months at St. Martin's as well?
I don't think there's been a huge amount of looking back, to be honest. I think everyone has really kind of embraced the new building and the opportunities. It's a great space to have a show. It's a great place to bring people to. It's a fantastic space to entertain in. Mm. So as a showcase for the students and the work and everything that the college is about, it's a much, much better window than we ever had before. And so I don't think anybody's really been going, oh, wasn't it great when we were back in the old building with the kind of thing was kind of falling down around our ears. Just so long as we get some of the kind of, you know, there was a bit of a clash with architectural vision meeting appropriate teaching spaces. So it's great to have a lot of concrete and a lot of bare wood, but it's not great to teach in that kind of space. And once those sorts of issues have been ironed out, you know, I think we'll be fine. We also have an architect as our new head of college, which is great. So he brings his own vision for kind of spaces and how he might have envisaged them as well. So, I mean, he was only presenting to us yesterday some exciting projects for how they're going to use the huge street space within the middle to kind of help make more visual sense of that.
Hopefully not lots of shops.
Not lots of shops.
Well, we'll come back and maybe move beyond the four walls and certainly talk about typography and good grids and everything else. A gentleman who might know a thing about grids, certainly in the area of Pimlico at the moment, is Peter York, a very regular voice here on Monocle 24. It says here on this, I didn't write the script today, but it says that you're a British management consultant, you're an author, you're a broadcaster, and of course you're contributing to the likes of The Independent on Sunday, GQ and Management today, but I think we're just you're an all-around, of course, fantastic commentator. We're very happy to have you here today, Peter York.
Thank you very much. Now, you didn't know that I'm also a pretend professor at UAL.
I did not. So can you paint us?
I am a visiting professor. I've gone through the whole thing with a Jacobean hat on.
How often do you visit?
I don't visit nearly enough. I say, use me. I don't cost any money. Use me more. I like going there. But my problem with the new St. Martin's is it's too tall. That is quite oppressive. Of course.
You're talking about the
new
when
building.
You walk into the
yes,
entry.
It's too atrial.
Mm.
It's too atrial, and it's got those sort of electronic gates, which is a bit scary, and there are these sort of blokes around.
When you go into this atrium environment, I trust you've done the grand tour and you've been to the workshops and all of these things. You've seen the 3D printers and everything like that. Mm. How do you feel about 3D printing?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I love the idea of 3D printing and producing little instant everything in the round. It's completely wonderful.
I want to... two things. We're at that point in the season right now when we look at the newsstand, and of course all of the summer specials are there. Only yesterday we finished our special issue of Monocle Mediterranea, which will be out in about 11 days' time. Peter, I imagine that you have a number of probably specials. I saw The Spectator was peeking at that. I want to come back to that right now. But do you think, Peter, that the newsstand comes into its own or should come into its own at this time of year? This is when it should really hum. It's sort of holiday season. It's when we have time to put our feet up. And do you think the new CEO at a company like WH Smith or the lovely French gentlemen who work at Relay in France recognize this?
No, I don't think they consciously re-merchandise and shout, this is the time of gorgeousness, in the way that they could. I was thinking that because I went to some modest magazine sellers today and I wasn't as excited as I ought to have been. People ought to have put all those things that have blue. They ought to put the glossy blue things to the front, but they didn't. You had to look for them.
Mm. And do you think that is to do with the fact that this is an industry which is without a leader at retail right now?
Well, I do think WH Smith is a very boring place, I'm afraid. He's got more boring, I think. Mm. Is that possible? I think it's got more boring. And it is clearly run as a sort of machine.
Mm.
And it has certain sort of built-in advantages and monopolies and sites and so on. But it has no recognition of quality or interest or, you know, real relationship with its consumers.
Mm.
It's not a, you don't want to go in there. You just have to because it's there.
Well, that's one of the amazing things. So often people bring in wonderful titles onto this program. Of course, this is heard around the world and there are W.H. Smiths around the world as well, for better or for worse. But people simply can't find them at W.H. Smith. It seems that the magazines are, I was going to say curated, they're not curated. They're bought, they're selected, I would imagine, by machine.
I think they are selected by machine. I think everything is selected by machine. We remember that the essential business of W.H. Smith is wholesaling.
Mm.
And that influences the whole organisation. It is stupendously dull.
Catherine, you returned recently, or I guess over the last year, you were teaching in Sao Paulo.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, do you think there's a program, some type of exchange that maybe the British Council could do or something, to bring some of those fantastic street... What happened to the street kiosk in this country?
I love those street kiosks.
The street kiosks in Sao Paulo are just amazing, and they're bountiful, and they probably have as many British titles, stacked up as they do Portuguese and Spanish titles and everything else.
Extraordinary international range of magazines. If you go to Avenida Paulista, I mean, it's extraordinary. Even my local kiosk on the street where I was living in my neighbourhood would have a really, really remarkable collection of magazines. It's something I hugely miss.
Mm.
And it's one of those things, one of those when you're a stranger in a new country things that the locals kind of couldn't quite get over my excitement over the kiosks. Because for them it was just, well, don't you have them in London? And it was like, no. Trying to buy a decent magazine, the number of times I've been at an airport and I thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to get a magazine to read on the plane. And then I've gone in to W.H. Smith or wherever and come out wanting, because I've just been so utterly uninspired or not really, I'll go and get a copy of so-and-so before I go. Nope. But the kiosk is great.
Mm. Peter, who killed off the kiosk on not even just the streets of London, but I think many cities? Was it the city that forced them into responsible real estate? What's happened to them?
I've no idea. And it is an extraordinary thing when you think about it, because they were wonderful and attractive and focused. And they had, there was one at Sloane Square, wasn't there?
Mm.
What's happened to that? Now, you see, suddenly you say it. What's happened to that? What's been done to that? Well, we have to ask the Cadogan estate about that.
We have to ask the Cadogan estate and many other estates. Mm. And I think Westminster and everywhere else.
There used to be one on Baker Street.
That's true. You're right.
Yes, inside, right sort of way down.
Mm. Clearly, I guess many people have been choked by the big chains. I imagine, though, Peter, probably people thought that they were grubby. And maybe a bit tatty, and so therefore we had to get them off the streets. I wonder if there was a component of that.
I don't know what the thinking was. The thinking is always how can you optimise that space for maximum return?
Mm.
How can you squeeze more money out of that space? How can you sell it off for something else?
Mm.
Which always, ironically, backfires on you because it's so obvious to anybody who's using whatever that space is.
And that's one of the remarkable things when you're in Sao Paulo. None of those kiosks are grubby. They're all beautifully polished stainless steel. Some of them are chrome or something. I mean, I don't know when they were built, but they're absolutely spotless, and you want to spend time in them. And as you said, I'm probably more likely to go to a newsstand in Sao Paulo and find titles that I simply wouldn't find in my neighbourhood here.
But it's also about a kind of relationship as well. I mean, they do fulfil other functions. I mean, you can buy all sorts of other little bits and bobs that are quite useful in that kind of local sense. And then you also just get to know the person who works in them really well. And if you use, because I would go and get my paper. I didn't have a paper delivered when I was living there, and I would just go and get my paper. I got to know the guy there really well. I would sometimes just leave the money if he was the other side of the street, or if I did. No, he was just great. So there was a kind of relational thing around kind of browsing. It wasn't just the fact that there was a huge quality.
Mm.
The ones in Buenos Aires were beautiful. I did travel down to Argentina, and actually the kiosks there in the as little kind of cabins were beautifully painted, and they often had handwritten lettering on the outsides of them. So, I mean, they were kind of like even a step above. I think the selection wasn't as good or as glossy, but as little spaces, they were even more beautiful.
I want to ask you first, do you miss Sao Paulo having returned to London? And I guess next question, I guess after that, just the pace and rhythm of this, you know, extraordinary emerging, not just city and economy, you know, versus where we sit here right now.
How could you not miss Sao Paulo? Although I think people, I mean, I read once, I think it was in the New York Times, it's the dirtiest, ugliest city you'll ever fall in love with. And I absolutely did fall head over heels. This is the sixth. I got back on Wednesday from another trip. It's the sixth trip to Sao Paulo, having lived there for a year. So, yes, it's just extraordinary. It's a slow burn city, though, and it's actually quite hard, I think, sometimes to kind of for other people to understand what it is about it. Because I know that when I was living there, my father came over, and it doesn't have a tick box list of attractions like Rio or London or Paris, where you can tick, I've seen this, I've seen this, I've seen this. It's a kind of, it's about the people and the bars and just the wealth of galleries, but it's a kind of a slow burn kind of the way that it kind of gets you, I think, in terms of what it has to offer.
We are talking to Catherine Dixon, Dr. Catherine Dixon, in fact, Senior Lecturer in Graphic Design at Central St. Martin School of Art, and of course, Peter York, and of course, many hats, and also a visiting lecturer at, is it UCL? Where did you say?
Well, no, at UAL.
Oh, UAL.
Which is the great conglomerate that contains St. Martin's.
Yes, exactly. More on that in a moment. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24.
Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre, and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
I always think we should have a competition here on The Stack to see who brings their titles in the most interesting sort of tote or carrier bag. And Peter has the most extraordinary array of plastic bags. I was actually thinking about you the other day, how you would get on the west coast of the United States, where they've banned plastic bags everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Not good for me.
Not good for you, because everything is still paper, and it's still sort of, you know, the rectangular traditional American paper bag. That's what saved it. It was, you know, it is interesting. You don't see paper bags plastic bags blowing around anymore.
No, well, I'm sure it's very, very worthy, and they do that sort of thing there. But I like a nice plastic bag. And I've got a lot of them.
Okay, these will travel around.
Yes, they have multi-uses and they have a lifetime.
Where do we want to start? I see Beyond the Lamp, I see Private Eye, I see The Spectator, I'm not sure if it's its summer special. But I think what's interesting, if I can just talk a little bit about the stack you've assembled before you, it's, I don't want to say it's predictable, but these are titles that we've all known to grow and love, and you've got a dependable stack, Peter.
I've got a very dependable stack. Here is one you may not know about quite so well. I don't think this is
25 beautiful homes. Okay, let's start there.
It's the Bible of the Middleton classes. So comfortable people in the home counties and similar places. It's their houses, and unlike rather grand magazines like House and Garden or Interiors, which have about four or five specially found interiors done usually by interior designers. These are the houses of real comfortable people, and there are 25 of them. So you know you're getting your value, and it shows you what comfortably off people in the UK, how they live now.
And do we never venture beyond? Are we ever at their their house in Provence, maybe?
Oh, no, more than that. There are also, it says 25 beautiful homes. You will find that there are homes in Oslo or places like that. It's most remarkable and exotic.
What stands out, and I think what position does it fill in the marketplace, do you think?
And here, spectacular views over Manhattan. So, New York penthouse. I think it reflects people back to themselves. I think it's very, in that sense, is very exciting. And it shows what people have done as opposed to what designers have done. Mostly, it isn't, mostly in the grand magazines, it's either the houses of the very rich done by designers or the houses of designers. And this is just the houses of ordinary, middling rich people.
Now, I'm buying this magazine because I want to be inspired. I want to maybe think about living in Oslo or high above Manhattan. Maybe for someone who's listening in Auckland or Buenos Aires, describe the man or woman who might pick this up at W.H. Smith. Because I imagine this probably does very well at W.H. Smith.
The man or woman who might pick this up at W.H. Smith is sort of, well, you just because if you're in any of those places, you will have read about the lovely Duchess of Cambridge and her family. You will have read about them. And this reflects that particular strand of British life, those sorts of people. These are people who have businesses and are doing well and often want quite modern things, but in a comfortable, not difficult way. They don't want to stretch the envelope or whatever it is. Here is a neglected Sydney property, Australian Terrace, you see, Dublin Terrace. It's not all.
And this is a magazine, countries. I would imagine you have to look at it on paper, don't you, Peter? It's
you have to look at it on paper. Oh, you have to look at it on paper. And if you're interested in the way we live now, as I am, that's my job, as I see it, then you have to read something like this. You don't just read stuff about what professionals do.
Catherine, what role does this type of title play in the marketplace? Because it seems that whether it's 25 Beautiful Homes or even House and Garden, etc., they've, and it doesn't matter what market these magazines appear in, they've slightly been overshadowed by so many of the new self-published, not quite sure how they're going to sustain themselves magazines that we've seen this incredible surge of, which is absolutely great for the paper industry. It's great for niche sites, of course, that sell these magazines. You know, it's great for the industry in general. And yet, there is a faction, of course, that peers down their nose at these things. Is it interesting, and is this part of the discussion in your classes, or is everyone only sort of migrating over to those titles right now that have the most interesting spot varnish and can use seven fluoros, etc.?
I mean, I think this magazine is about reassurance as much as anything else. I think it's about reassuring a certain set of people that they're getting it right and they're kind of on track on the kind of lifestyle that they think that they should be leading. I think graphic design is about meeting people where they're at, and I think there are lots of different kinds of graphic design. I think there are lots of different kinds of magazines, and so I think a lot of those newer self-publishing titles are meant for a younger audience, and I just think this isn't. This is meant for somebody who's... I would have thought this is for somebody much older. And in every way, it feels very traditional. It's typography, it's layout.
It's not being clever.
It's not being clever, but it doesn't need to. It's not its job to be clever.
No.
Do you think this surge that we've seen in self-published titles, and of course there are, there are various scales and budgets, when you talk about a younger audience, is this almost a post-magazine generation? Is this a generation's actually discovered print that they spent much more time, I guess, when they were, finding their place on the sofa, it was much more television, but also not television with just four channels in this country or three channels if you were in Sweden. But it was a world of satellite television. And then, of course, maybe a desktop and then to a laptop, etc. And maybe, I'm sure maybe in many households, magazines weren't really part of what was going on the coffee table.
No, I was horrified. I mean, I agree. I was horrified, kind of horrified, but in a kind of, not that's too strong a word, but I was amazed when I was listening to some students talking. And I realised that the computer for them is work. It's their social life. They watch television on their computers. They don't even watch television on a television anymore. Mm. Everything revolves around the computer. And I think it can be no accident that the kind of material qualities of books and of magazines in the short run are being explored by a generation that is just so digital. They kind of take that so much for granted that actually I think it has a lot to offer. Students are excited by print processes, risograph machines, handles that they have to turn, stitching, letterpress, the kind of physicality of engaging with something. For them, that's actually very new and exciting because they're from such a generation that they don't have any of the remnants of the past of that, and they're coming to that very fresh. And so I find that in some senses, students don't really feel that they've made anything unless they've kind of hand-cranked a machine a couple of hundred times and hand-stitched some pages together.
Is this just a moment in time, Peter? It's a blip. Everyone goes back.
I think it's
to doing
just a sort of farmer's market of magazines. And I can understand all those tiny things, but I don't want them very much for very long. And, of course, if you've been through several cohorts of small magazine publishing, do you know, an 80s one, in fact, there was a 70s one too, because all the little magazines that were printed and developed around punk, and then an 80s one and a 90s one. Mm. You're quite bored by the business of little magazines, little wanky magazines, because you know what their agenda will be, roughly. You know what locations in the world they'll be interested in and what sorts of art and music. And it's quite tiresome.
It's also fascinating because, just as you were saying that, I was trying
yet
to...
Yet, darling.
I was trying to place Blitz, The Face, Sky, all 80s, and they're all gone. And I guess to both of you, Catherine, these were titles that I imagine that probably students bring them in. They're titles that you would have certainly grown up with as well. Do they... Well, I guess two things. One... They pass their sell-by date because they were overtaken, do you think, by digital media? I would just say sort of video in general. Most of them were sort of almost killed off by that point. Or is there a cycle when it comes to typography and approach to styling, the arrangement of a page, that it becomes very hard to reinvent yourself after a while?
That's a bigger a question, bigger than I am. I wonder about the longevity of the current blip, certainly. I wonder about because I think it is a kind of a reaction, and I do wonder about the longevity. But I don't think it's any accident that we have publishers such as Visual Editions producing these exquisite books with cutouts and that kind of visual exploration at this moment in time. I also wonder about how interested in being mainstream people are anymore, and how... especially in the UK as well. And I wonder about this. I have absolutely no evidence for this. It's a pure speculation. But when I was in Brazil, there seems to be... The Brazilian culture is far more about following a norm and not being seen to step outside of that.
Mm.
Whereas, when I was living there, I could always kind of play the slightly eccentric Londoner kind of card, as people would like look me up and down and think, well, gosh, that's not quite what the done outfit for this kind of occasion. whereas in London, you do have that reassurance, and people comment to me from, people from even coming from Germany, they say, gosh, people wear anything here. And you do have that kind of thing. You could just walk into a bar dressed as Minnie Mouse and nobody would really bat an eyelid here. And so I wonder if there's something about that kind of desire to always, especially in the kind of student generations, people in their 20s, just pull away and say, no, we're about this, we're not about that, but we're kind of just throwing things up in the air. And I think there's something about that that's kind of...
I just want it to be a better kind of pulling away. A less wanky, indulgent, bourgeois kind of pulling away. It's the loss of the pop aesthetic. Doing something that will go big and go exciting, that is different, yet potentially very big. And I think it may very well be that the mechanics of media and everything else make that very much more difficult.
Mm. We can go back and we could all jump in the car and go to one of the lockups we have somewhere out in West London where we have all of our copies of all of these British style, you know, these great British style magazines. And you know, they represent not just a moment in time, but they represent, you know, 7 or 8 years. They represent, a decade. And I think they, you know, whether it's advertising, what was the color of the moment, you sort of look at, the spacing of headlines, everything. There is this true sort of representation of pop culture. Peter, I wonder if we fast forwarded, 20 years from now, what titles would we go back to? Because on one side, yes, you can go and find web pages, but I imagine 20 years time, it's going to be very difficult. Do you think that we will have these tomes and titles that represent where we are today?
No, but because that game will be over. I think the entire game will be over. But retrospectively, and look, if you look at the prices that certain kinds of magazines achieve now, you can see what is valued already in that lockup. If in that lockup you've got a lot of, say, Andy Warhol's interview, and I love the way they said Andy Warhol interview, and when I met Bob Colicello, who was at that point editing it first, way, way back, I said, tell me, Mr. Colicello, what is the philosophy of interview? And he said, oh, we don't have a philosophy. We just believe in money and beauty. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to say. And he was obviously saying it because he thought I was rather a pious British person and had misunderstood my question. But I think it is interesting to see what already in the vintage magazine market attracts proper money. And that's one. The face is another.
Absolutely.
But I think as for the, yes, for wonderful art direction. And I think the whole little magazine thing will be, you can see people doing a lot of things in the flight and the flight or fight against all sorts of online productions. But most of the things are quite silly.
I do completely agree with indulgence. And actually, I just went to the magazine stands yesterday afternoon just to have a flick through. And I was kind of, there are magazines which are just feel very indulgent in terms of the fact that it's very similar kind of photography, very similar kind of paper stock, very similar kind of typography, and typography that I can't really read. And then that just drives
That's
me
annoying.
Nuts. Because I just think, well, if it's about the content or it's not about, if it's not about the content, then don't pretend it is about the content. Just make it about the images and make it about the feel, but make it a whole lot more exciting.
And is that the type of critique you would give one of your students?
Yeah.
No, it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like, well, have the courage of your convictions. If it's really about the content, then put it to me in a way that I can read. If it's really not about the content, then put it to me in a way that's just going to, just take my breath away as I turn the pages. But don't kind of pretend one way or the other. And that just feels, I also feel there's a bit of copycatness out there. Where I just kind of flicked through a lot of magazines. I thought, well, you want to be that, don't you, really? But you're not quite. They just kind of had that sort of feel.
I'd love to eavesdrop on these critiques. It'd be, yes. It'd be brilliant. Tell me, when you go through this process as well, and it is so easy. You don't have to spend much time even going you don't have to venture out to lockups in West London. It's all there online. What's the migration of the curriculum been like for you over the last sort of 5 or 6 years? Just the space of change, this sort of the great influence. We saw sort of blogs move to print. We were in a self-publishing era. We've seen the collapse of so many great magazines. How does that, I guess, keep you sharp as a professor?
I think it's always, I think when we teach, especially at St. Martin's, I wouldn't say exclusively at St. Martin's, you're not teaching people to produce a particular end product. You are really about teaching people how to see and think about the context in which they are and to respond to content and kind of appropriate to that context. So I think you're, as much as anything, always encouraging students to ask questions about what's around them. And in that sense, there's a continuity, because in that sense, that's kind of fundamental to what design is. Rather than, yes, there's software or techniques or technologies or kind of how that's made manifest and or realised, which, and there are aspects of that which have to be learnt. But actually, such is the breadth of what's now possible because of print and because of tech, because of websites and because of blogs and because of tablets. There's almost so much that a student would have to learn. They also make animations and they work in moving image that you kind of can't even begin to try and cover half of it. So actually that kind of gets you to kind of bed down and focus on the core things, which is about the thinking. And then kind of, you know, students will specialise off into certain kind of areas of work. Although what's tending to happen now with the really exciting agencies, it's a huge amount of collaboration. So you'll get a graphic designer working with a programmer, working with a product designer, kind of creating these small agencies, really working in kind of new spaces and creating the spaces. Rather than adhering to any particular idea. It's rare that you get a student, not unheard of, but it is rare that you get a student that says, I want to be a magazine designer or I want to be a this designer. That's increasingly rare. They don't really have that vision of what graphic design is anymore. They have a much, much broader vision of the possibilities of how and where they might work.
Is there a sense that you need to anchor them in it? And that doesn't necessarily mean, or maybe it does mean, that good typography, no matter where we are in the cycle of technology, it still has to be legible on page. It still needs to be ink on paper, potentially at some point, or not. It would be interesting to know what that student thinks right now.
I mean, I think, again, yes, we try to talk a little bit about some of the basic principles. And actually, that's more important than ever, because I think for a long while, what students have been, or designers have been able to get away with, certainly with typography, which is often a really intimidating subject and people tend to shy away from or be a little intimidated or scared by, is they've learned a few templates. They've learned, or that typeface more or less works in that sort of situation. They've learned a few kind of, oh, that'll work. And they've got a few sort of in a repertoire of kind of things that they can always play that are kind of going to work. With the diversity of platforms that you've got now, you can't work like that anymore. You have got to really understand the fundamentals of reading and starting to think about the effect of text and white space and managing that so that you can adapt and work with programmers who are going to adapt layouts for many different kinds of formats. So you've really got to understand, well, actually at this given point I really need that line to break and we need to go to two columns because I really don't want an everlasting column, that kind of thing. So it's about really getting to grips with the basics.
Peter, when we look at this screen here, the one I'm hitting, do we talk about typography when we see a backlit screen, or is it, do we automatically end up into a world of we talk about the animation and we talk about motion graphics. Are we ever focusing on, you know, just the cut of the A or the thinness of the B?
I think sometimes, and mostly, we're not. And in fact, it's, as you say, it's not the word you use. But when you think about, I think when people's websites, where they're wanting to make a particular kind of impression, and the typography is pretty much, you know, a very, very important component. It's lovely having full motion video, but the typography is the way you say what kind of place you are, what kind of brand you are, and then it does become important. That combination, you know, do you want to say that we're rich or we're edgy or we're, well, any of those things, and then it becomes terribly important.
We're going to take a very short break. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
It's that time of year when Monocle's mighty July-August double issue hits the newsstands with a glorious and satisfying thud. It's the issue where we name the best cities to call home, meet the people who know how to run a good metropolis, check out the businesses that care about more than profits, and also find a few dustier, grittier places that you should know. Here's what our editors have lined up for you to enjoy on your lounger.
In the design section, we go street cleaning with the wonderful Greenbird team in Tokyo. We knock on the doors of the people who live in the pioneering Harlan estate outside Bern, and we strip off for a steamy fashion story in Helsinki's newest, cutest public sauna.
In the edit section, we take you for a stroll around some of the world's best public parks, including Singapore Gardens by the Bay, Margaret Island in Budapest, and São Paulo's Ibirapuera Park, three places where you can work out surrounded by nature, sculptures, and open-air cinema.
The July-August issue of Monocle also includes our inaugural 68-page food and entertaining guide and a 24-page Rio de Janeiro survey. It will keep you content with content all summer long. It's on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
At the top of the program, we were talking about great newsstands in Sao Paulo, what happened to them in London and whatnot. Well, this summer in Brooklyn, an empty subway newsstand at Metropolitan Avenue Station has been transformed into a pop-up celebration of independent print media. It features magazines, books, and journals, and it's giving a fresh lease on life to an established newsstand niche. The Platform Kiosk, started by the creative company All Day Every Day. The shop is curated by photographer Lele Saveri, who also organizes a biannual print fair called 8-Ball. Our Pauline Eiferman met him at the newsstand.
We are in a subway station on Lorimer on the L at Metropolitan, and we are outside the newsstand.
So tell me how this project started.
The project started just by chance. I curate, I'm a photographer and do videos, and I worked as photo editor for a while for a magazine, and I was curating a gallery, so I've always been like curating different things. I do this thing twice a year called 8-Ball Zine Fair, where I get a bunch of publishers and zine makers to sell their books on top of pool tables in billiards. And these guys called All Day Every Day, it's a company that I work with as a photographer. They helped me out on the last zine fair in December, and I liked how it was a physical thing, it wasn't a blog thing. And they usually work on the web. So they were like, oh, we need to do more pop-up things, things that like last for some time, and then more like about gathering people together in a physical way. And one of them, Jamie, just walked past this newsstand that had been closed since September. And he had an idea of maybe doing something in there, like a bookstore or something. So they asked me if I wanted to curate and put together stuff. And we worked on like finding the space, getting the lease up, and then I just worked on collecting different books and zines and getting people together to submit stuff.
So how did you curate this space? Can you maybe pick out three magazines that you think kind of represent the style?
I didn't really go for magazines, but I selected a group of independent New York bookstores that were specialized in certain type of books, and I asked them to give me their favorite selection and fit them into a box. So I built all of these boxes and I got these bookstores to select stuff. So Dashwood, for instance, they do more photography. Desert Island does more comic books. McNally and Jackson did the magazines, for instance. Or we have Karma to do more art books and reading books. Ed Varier is this other gallery, Oh Wow.
Can you show us a little selection of your favorite stuff?
Yes. I'm going to show you, first of all, this is a new book by Peter Sutherland. He's guest clerking today together with Maya.
What does that mean?
I have like some artist friends that I asked to come and work for one day and curate the space. So the space keeps on changes, and they bring their own books. They bring their favorite books. They pick the stuff that they like the most in the shop, and they rearrange, and then they bring prints to fill it up. I just want the store to look different every day, because there's so many commuters. I want the commuters to still come in and always find new stuff.
And can you tell me what the day is like here? Who comes in? What they do?
It's very interesting. Like, being in this neighborhood, we also get obviously a whole lot of I don't know how to call it, like more younger white students, artsy kids, obviously, which are probably the ones that spend more money here, and it's great for like in terms of business. But the people that I love to hang out with the most are the people that are taking the G. So it's the whole of Brooklyn that just comes in and they find a new spot. And very many of these people have been embracing this way more than the people that already know what a zine is, you know? And that's, to me, that's the success. In the moment in which I get somebody that just, there was this woman that came in yesterday with a kid. The kid only wanted candies, and they were so blown away by like the selection of comic books and Busan magazine. And I spent $40 full of zines and comics. To me, that's like totally amazing. It's exactly what I want to like reach out to.
And what's unique about being underground here? I mean, you're used to having zine fairs in big spaces and in this weird environment of a subway. Because the New York subway is not a very comfortable place to be in. It's really hot right now. Everyone's sweating. It's not like in certain countries where you can just hang out.
Yeah, I know. The best thing about being underground, I said it already, but I think it's totally the best thing, is that there's no cell phones. There's no distractions in that sense. So people, when they come here and they have a book in their hands, they actually only concentrate on that book. They have no way of like getting texts or having to text somebody or getting phone calls or having to blog this to somebody else or telling people that this is happening or whatever. That's not none of that. All they do is like they have a book, they stop for a second and look at the book. Maybe they take a picture on their way out, and they often do, but it's all down to that moment. They can actually, when they're talking to me, they're not like lost, you know what I mean? Like often happens in any magazine, in any bookstores or in any other shops in New York. Like people are always kind of there and kind of not. So that's I think is the main thing. And then you just see like flow of people going all the time. When the trains gets here, sometimes it gets crazy, and then you have like this moment of quiet and there's nobody around because no train gets here. And then again flows and then stop. So it's beautiful for people watching for sure.
And that was our Pauline Eiferman talking to Lele Severi of course, the company All Day Every Day, about their platform kiosk. Anyway, Pete, do you think there's a room? Maybe you should talk to Transport for London, or maybe Hong Kong's, you know.
I do like the idea, and I should talk to Transport for London. I've just done a book about the tube. Mm. I feel very tube inclined. There is one platform, literally, where you have a thing, a kiosk straight on the platform, which is a sort of multiple kiosks, magazines and sweets and stuff, and I can't remember exactly where it is. Mm. There used to be a bar at Sloane Square.
Imagine.
So I think it's a very good idea.
We are talking to Peter York and Dr. Catherine Dixon, Senior Lecturer in Graphic Design at Central St. Martin's. We're going to go for a very short break, but before we do that, Catherine, I'm going to ask you to, probably you've got so many magazines there, but we don't have much time left on the program. So when we're off on a break, select the three that we're going to talk about, and that will even be ambitious. This is the Stack on Monocle 24. And very whizzy fast break again. Okay, so I'm actually intrigued by plastic. Am I allowed to ask about plastic? Because I haven't seen it before, but I don't know if we want to talk about that or not. But describe what's in front of you.
Well, plastic is an unusual magazine because it's free. It's free. You get it in the store, but you get it in one of the most amazing stores in the world. And because it's the one of the flagship stores of Melissa, the shoe manufacturers, Brazilian shoe manufacturers in Oscar Freire in São Paulo. And it's art directed by Pedro Inui. And it's just a joy because it's just about promoting shoes. But so many of the times when you get these kind of free kind of promotional magazines, they kind of like don't come up to much in terms of art direction. But actually, this is extraordinary. It's just a joy. It's so much so that I've had this one quite a while and I've just kept it because I just really love, well, I love the shoes for one thing. But I just really like the approach to the art direction. It's just a lot of fun, but at the same time, it actually has some quite serious bits and pieces, kind of the way it's just been brought together. Mm. It's just a joy.
I'm familiar with the company, but do they put all of their marketing budget into this one piece? Because oftentimes we see major brands, they decide to pick one sort of main battle. They're on a digital strategy, they only spend on TV, or do you see them across all platforms in Brazil?
It's hard to know because, they are here in London a little bit, but they're not so present. And I really know them through the store that they have in São Paulo. Mm. I know that they do have their shoes in other smaller stores, but it's in this main flagship store. I've never seen an advert for them on the television. Mm. I can't imagine that would happen. But you do see bits and pieces about them in the press or in the fashion press. But it's just that this is a kind of vehicle. So whenever you go in the store, they have a big pile of them. Whenever you buy anything, they'll give you one of these. And like I say, normally when you get that kind of promotional piece of material, it just goes straight in the bin. But actually, this is so well done that I just kept it. And I'm actually slightly kicking myself because when I was there last week, I could have got another one.
You could have got another one, yeah. Can't. Okay, title number two.
Title number two. Well, I bought Port Magazine, but I bought Port Magazine because I love Port Magazine, but I know that I'm not the intended reader. But I kind of find that quite frustrating. And I often find myself on the slightly the wrong side of the kind of bank of magazines in Smith's. And then I suddenly realise that all these men are kind of looking at me quite strangely. Because I just think there's some really nice things happening with men's magazines at the moment, new titles, and they are very targeted at
men.
There's
a lot of action in men's land.
And it just, I just find it, in this particular edition, which is issue 10, the latest one, has the most amazing section on vintage sports cars, which is just a joy because they're just beautiful. There's a section, there's a really nice piece on Kenneth Grange, featuring a great some great diagrams of his work, some great trains. And I've just kind of, if they could just put a frock in every now and then, I'd be really happy.
Or would you be happy? You sort of...
Maybe. Well, no, see, I don't need a new suit. That's why I really don't need a new suit. So there are sections which really do go over my head, but then it just, but actually in terms of the art direction, and as of, I really love this magazine. In terms of the typography, the attention to detail, just the kind of range of the stories and bits and pieces that they have in it, I find it a joy. So I kind of brought it, even though it's not really meant for me, but I do like
it. Peter, are you docking at Port?
No. But I think, in general, the whole category has a new generation, new cohort within it, and it'd be interesting to see who wins out. And it's because, obviously, people think that there's going to be a whole lot more advertising there, that that's going to be an explosive area of advertising as men get the way they've always been predicted to get. You know, each generation, each decade, people have said men are going to start spending, men are going to start doing these things, and then they don't. And it just doesn't happen.
Girls buy them.
Girls buy them. I don't know. You know, and maybe this time, this new generation of one will hit something, and that one or two will make old bones.
Time for one more, Catherine.
I just bought, we have been talking about self-publishing, and I just bought Boat Magazine, which I just love as a concept. So I heard David Spence talking about this project. So the idea to kind of, that we get a lot of negative stories from particular cities around the world, and the idea that you would go stay there, kind of try and sort of become embedded, I suppose, and try and kind of dig for some stories which are far represent various cities around the world which have a very negative profile in a far more positive light. I just thought it was a very nice thing.
I think you look more intrigued, Peter, that we've gone from port to boat.
And I'm looking at this upside down, of course, and I can see it's about Detroit. And I think Detroit is now a very weird area of sort of class tourism and slum tourism, and you saw the Julian Temple's film about it, and it is fascinating, but I'm not sure we ought to be doing it.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that they, well, actually part of the reason that they went there is because of a kind of, as a kind of, to try and counterpoint some of that with the stories, because it's about trying to find voices from people from Detroit to tell their story as opposed to us projecting onto it.
And it's not a call to action for us to probably go there for summer holidays.
No, and very much it says that, yeah. It very much says it's not about trying to kind of sell it as a city. Yeah.
Dr. Catherine Dixon, Senior Lecturer of Graphic Design at Central St. Martin, thanks very much for coming on. We'd love to have you back. It was great. Have a fantastic summer as well.
Thank you very much.
Seems to have arrived in this city for the moment. Peter York, great to see you. Hopefully we'll have you back even over the course of this. Are you going anywhere nice?
I never go anywhere. I always go to Edinburgh for the Tele Festival.
Right.
That's a treat for me.
Okay, well, hopefully we can check in with you there. That brings us to the end of this 45th edition of The Stack here at Midori House. My guests today, of course, have been Peter York and Dr. Catherine Dixon. Our producers were David Michon and David Pleasant. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Brazilian there for you, Catherine. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a line to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. I won't be in the seat. I will be on summer holiday. Another editor will be standing in. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, have a great weekend. Goodbye.